If you do a quick Google search for cancer support groups in Kansas City, you turn up an impressive range of results. There are so many that Yelp has compiled a list of the best 16 in the metro. That's because cancer is a disease so prevalent it's touched almost everyone's life in some way or another. But what do you do if you've just been diagnosed with a disease that barely anyone has even heard of? Or maybe you're starting to exhibit mysterious symptoms that there is no community to validate, no support group to turn to for tips and encouragement. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about rare diseases on KCUR's Central Standard. From obstacles to getting diagnosed to the complicated search for community. My first guest is Kelly Rinaldo. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
So you have founded a pretty new organization called Rare Casey, and it is specifically for people who have rare diseases?
Yes, it is.
Can you explain, like, the kinds of needs your organization exists to fill?
So I think, as you pointed out, one of the biggest challenges when you have a rare disease is you feel really isolated. There really isn't an easy way to get a community, especially if you're in what we call ultra-rare diseases. And so the first point of Rare KC is really connecting families, allowing them to have a community that they can build off of. And then in addition to that, being able to figure out how do you connect with doctors that understand your disease, or even at the end, trying to find researchers that might bring you new hope for treatments.
Tell the story of how you came to this work, what happened in your own life and in your family.
My husband and I, after we moved here to Kansas City and we met in college, we had four children. And our first daughter, Allie, was born. She's 21 now. But she was born, and when she was first born, there were some things that were a little bit different. But being a first-time mom, you just never really know because you're a first-time mom. You don't know the difference.
Yeah, you expend a lot of energy assuring yourself, I'm sure this is normal.
Exactly. So after Allie was born, my husband George and I, we went on to have another daughter. Her name was Katie. And when Katie was born, even at the hospital immediately, I noticed that something was different and something was wrong. But again, I was assured by the physician or pediatrician at the time that everything looked great. It wasn't until 2 weeks later that when we took her to a regular 2-week checkup that immediately my pediatrician, who's our full-time physician, she knew immediately. She gave that look that no mom wants to see, which is, I'll be right back. I'm going to go and make a couple phone calls, and then we'll be back and talk about this. So long story short, our second daughter, Katie, was misdiagnosed with a condition when she was about 2 weeks old. That sent us on a road trip around the United States, because a lot of times when you have a
child... Wait, can I stop you
sure.
here? Because how did you know that there was a misdiagnosis? It seems like if you're going off on a journey, you're doing so feeling like you haven't found the answers you needed.
Right. So they originally diagnosed Katie because they diagnosed her based on her symptoms. And so they diagnosed her because she had what was called clouded corneas. And so that was her diagnosis that we were given. And so that's where we sent off to try to find the specialist specifically for that. But along the journey, as common a lot of rare diseases, is as you're on your journey, you start finding other bits and pieces that don't make sense at the time.
So is it common to get a misdiagnosis? Because I would think that, of course, it's medical professionals, like all professionals, are used to seeing a certain range of things and kind of make observations through that lens. So it's like these symptoms usually are fill in the blank.
Right. You're absolutely right. I think this is one of the big challenges of having a rare condition is what happens if your doctor hasn't seen it or isn't familiar with it? Because as we know, there's about 7,000 different rare genetic conditions. And so can your doctor be an expert in every single one of them?
Oh, man. Okay. So you go on a journey around to find specialists for clouded corneas?
We did. So, and again, we are very privileged. My husband and I had the resources to be able to say, we're going to go seek out best of the best. And because I was trained as a physical therapist, I already had some connections in the healthcare community to help me navigate what that journey would look like. So we started here at Children's Mercy in Kansas City. But again, even back then, and again, this was 18 years ago, they didn't have the specialists that Katie really needed at the time. And so we used our resources. We went to the Mayo Clinic, and then we went down to Children's Hospital, Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. All of them not quite putting all of the pieces together. So we ended up with a team up in Minnesota, and that's where we found our transplant team.
So wait, what was the diagnosis?
So at that point in time, again, they were only giving us the diagnosis that she had clouded corneas. And so the treatment at that point in time, we had to make the decision at a very young age whether or not to proceed with corneal transplants or my daughter wouldn't have any hope of vision.
So you went ahead and decided to have a transplant?
We did.
But still, we don't have a diagnosis?
We don't.
When do we get a diagnosis?
I've
been talking to you for like 3 minutes and I'm getting impatient. This is years of your life.
Right.
Sorry.
So we didn't get a diagnosis. Unfortunately, as we were going back and forth to Minnesota for the follow-up visits for her corneal transplants, Katie actually went into cardiac arrest and we lost her at 5 months old. So unfortunately for our family, we didn't get an accurate diagnosis until they actually did her autopsy postmortem.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. Thank you.
And what did this end up revealing for your other daughter? Because you had mentioned that she had also been exhibiting symptoms at birth that you thought something's different here. Something's going on.
Right. So that's the challenge. So once we got the diagnosis, which was determined to be an ultra rare condition, the first concern we had is, could it be genetic in nature? And do we need to have our other daughter evaluated? So, of course, we immediately did that. So we went through full genetic testing. And again, genetic testing back then wasn't what it's like today. And so we went through full genetic testing and they gave her a clean bill of health. They said she was fine.
What ended up happening with
that? Well, this becomes another problem in rare disease is because, you know, it's challenging because a lot of times your doctors don't see the symptoms. So you already get deemed a little bit crazy and maybe a hypochondriac.
And then if you keep pushing even harder.
Yes, exactly.
Have you seen the Seinfeld where there's the doctor puts a note in Elaine's file and it kind of follows her through her medical history, like difficult patient.
Right. And so that's what we become, right? We become those hypervigilant moms, those moms that are looking for something. And, you know, as I always tell people, the last thing I want to look for is something in any of my children. So by this point in time, we had chosen to have two other boys as well. But even with Allie, there kept being things that didn't make sense. She was tiny. She was petite. We kept being told she's a girl. Don't worry. She'll catch up. And it wasn't until she was about 8 and a half that I finally sat in her pediatrician's office and said, I'm not leaving until you run a test. And then we got the diagnosis. She was diagnosed with a different rare condition, but she was diagnosed with Turner syndrome at the age of 8 and a half.
Wow. What a journey to be on. And what, I mean, I'm imagining the courage and self-confidence it takes to be able to say, I'm not leaving until you run a test.
It certainly does. I mean, I think if you talk with a lot of rare disease families, having a voice and really being able to challenge the healthcare system when you as a mom or a parent have a gut feeling, that is a hard task to do.
And when you really want to be partners, I'm guessing.
Not only really wanting to be partners, but realizing, especially in a rare disease, if you upset or you become in conflict with your healthcare team, where else are you going to go?
You know, the fact that something is rare does seem like it would have some built-in challenges when it comes to finding community and support, when it comes to getting a diagnosis. But I am really intrigued by the idea that rare disease sufferers have things in common, even if the specific diagnosis is different from person to person. And you're talking about 7,000 plus rare genetic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge range of situations people are facing, but just the fact that the disease is rare means that they are having a shared experience.
Correct. I mean, I think one of the challenges, there's a lot of unique and unmet challenges when you consider having a rare condition. One, the diagnosis. So the average time that it takes for a patient or a family to get an accurate diagnosis is about 8 to 10 years. So you can imagine the commonalities of being on that journey, independent of what your disease state, of going doctor to doctor or trying to find answers or really trying to convince people that you're not crazy. But then once you get a diagnosis, again, the challenge is the specialist might not be here in your hometown or here in Kansas City. You might have to access physicians all over the country to be able to get that.
Call 816-235-2888 if you have insights into this whole journey with uncommon medical conditions, whether you're the patient, a family member, or medical professional who's struggled to identify a condition. What is it that the rest of us really need to understand? 816-235-2888. Shortly, we will be hearing from someone who faced her own rare diagnosis as an adult, but first, another parent on this journey, Janelle Ridenour. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Gina.
How do you relate to what we just heard from Kelly Rinaldo?
Yeah, you know, our journey was a little bit different with Theo. So my son has a condition called Rubenstein-Tabie. And it is, we actually got an earlier diagnosis, so we were very lucky in that sense. But what we are as a family is an example of what an early diagnosis can do for a family. So Theo was born with a congenital heart defect. I was told at my 20-week ultrasound that he was going to be born with a defect that was incompatible with life, which was really challenging.
Is that the phrasing that was used?
It was, yes. And so it was initially we were told it was incompatible with life, and then we were told that we could get surgery, but he would need surgery within the first days of life, open heart surgery.
Can you take me to the doctor's appointment where there is a medical professional informing you of this condition, describing to you what it is, and you are reacting to this information? Because as someone who's gone through the pregnancy experience myself, I have a hard time imagining being told in that language, that information.
Yeah, you know, our doctors were amazing, and they delivered the news in the way that, you know, I think they could do the best. But it was heartbreaking. We were shattered. We have two older children, and you know, my first thought was, how do we tell them? How do we get them through this process of knowing that maybe they weren't getting a younger sibling, maybe they were just getting an angel. And so it was really challenging for us. But we kept going back to the doctor. We kept getting more ultrasounds, and the story kept getting a little bit better in that we were told that maybe Theo would live as long as we had the surgery right away. And then Theo came early, which was not planned. And we were supposed to get his open heart surgery out in Boston, because that's where they were able to do the procedure, because it was such a rare, even heart condition. And so he was born here, and then we were flown to Boston about a week of age, and he had open heart surgery at 10 days of age. And at that point, we actually still didn't have a diagnosis of a rare disease. We were just told that it was a heart condition. And it was then... you know, I have a very distinct memory of that moment as well. We were in a waiting room, a single window, and my husband and I were sitting there waiting for the doctor to come in and tell us, you know, how Theo was doing, because he wasn't doing well, and we couldn't figure out why after the surgery, when my phone rang, and it was Children's Mercy here in Kansas City where he'd been born, and they were telling us that the first time I'd ever heard these words, which were Rubenstein-Tabie, which was the rare disease that Theo was diagnosed with.
So you knew that there was a reason to have surgery and that there was a reason to be concerned at 20 weeks into your pregnancy.
Correct.
And you knew you got a diagnosis about a week into his life.
Yes, ma'am.
That period between those two times, were you working with any understanding of why this was happening, or just with the absence of that knowledge?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. So I'm a healthcare provider. I actually work in healthcare. And, you know, when I first saw Theo, I had wondered about some of his physical characteristics. I had wondered if there was more than just the heart condition going on. But we were so focused on the heart and the surgery, and my heart was still broken about what was happening with him at that point, that I almost really even couldn't accept that maybe there was more to it.
Yeah, that it wasn't just going to be over after the surgery.
Right, yes.
So remind us of the name of the disease and explain what it is.
So Rubenstein-Tabie, it's a rare disease, and it kind of affects every part of Theo. It's a syndrome. It affects his ability to communicate with us. He is nonverbal. He'll turn 4 in March, but he communicates with us via sign language. He has, besides the heart condition, has lots of feeding and growing issues. We spend lots of time in doctor's offices, as most kiddos and parents of kids with rare diseases do. He has lots of tone issues and delays in lots of different ways. But I do want to add, though, I always hate talking about all his medical diagnoses without adding that he is one of the happiest, sweetest, most wonderful children you will ever meet.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like your journey as a parent with him is different than you expected, but it is its own kind of path that you're on.
Yes, it is. It's our own path. And as we were kind of mentioning earlier, I think, you know, our journey is a little bit different because we were able to get a diagnosis early. And how that was able to help us is that we were then able to get services that Theo needed very early, which is one of the reasons why when you compare him to other children with his syndrome, which we have to do via the internet because they're all over the world, he's a little ahead of the game. And I think that is because we were able to get early intervention.
Do you think that your early diagnosis does have to do with the fact that you're a healthcare professional who maybe was in a position to ask the quote unquote right questions, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it definitely, you know, in this case, I think that because of his heart defect, they ran the genetic testing. But I think that
there was an obvious clue that something was amiss.
Right. But I do think that my advantage of being a healthcare provider is that one of our hardest parts of being a parent like this is that you don't know what services are available to your children. And so being a healthcare provider, I'd already kind of been in the mix, even if it had been on the other side. And so I was able to go out and say, you know, I know my son needs early intervention. I know my son needs this. I know my son needs this. And I know he needs this MRI to rule this out sort of thing. So,
you know, I think it is a logical sort of it's a logical thing that when you're suffering and trying to find answers and you're getting really frustrated with the whole situation, to be frustrated with the doctors or with insurance companies or with everyone along that path who is supposed to be there to help you in your mind, but it's not helping. Do you, as a medical professional, see that from the other side?
You know, you see it from both sides now. I definitely see it from both sides. I see the part where I get frustrated because I'm the parent that's not being listened to. And I see the healthcare provider who I've been on that side too, where I'm like, you know what? We don't, as healthcare providers, we're not necessarily taught to look for the zebras. You know, if it fits in a box and looks in a box, then we should put it in this box.
And yeah. And is this animal black or white? It cannot be striped.
Exactly. And so it's, you know, I can definitely see it from both sides.
And you mentioned that your community is a global community and an online community when it comes to the particular disease that your son has. Can you talk about how you found that community?
Yeah. You know, I my heart hurts for the folks who 10 years ago, 15 years ago, didn't have things like Facebook and the internet to help them through this process. We have been able to find on Facebook actually a community of other parents who have kiddos with Rubenstein-Tabe, and we have made friends with parents who live in Israel and Egypt and Russia and all over the world. And all of us have very similar little kiddos that we're raising.
Can you talk about an example of something where that community and the support that it offered, or the knowledge, someone else being maybe a couple years further down that road than you, has been of real use for you?
Yeah, you know, well, in particular, I've made friends with a mom out in Colorado. She's a nurse, so we both have healthcare backgrounds, and our kiddos are actually about the same age. My child is just a few months older than hers, and it's not necessarily that we've been able to help each other in the sense of that but we can help each other because we're both in it in the now. We're both dealing with a lot of the same issues, and that emotional support that we can give each other has been priceless.
This is KCUR's Central Standard. We're talking about experiences shared by people with rare diseases. Call 816-235-2888 with your story. In just a minute, we'll hear from a woman with something called common variable immunodeficiency. And don't let the common part of it fool you. It is not common, and that's why it took so long to get treatment. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about medical conditions that are hard to diagnose, treat, and form community around because the conditions themselves are extremely rare. One of our guests formed an organization, Rare KC, to help people on that journey. Kelly Rinaldo, welcome back.
Thanks, Gina.
We're also joined by a parent who had to push to get her son to form community around a disease her son had. And now I want to welcome Angela Van Batavia to the show. Angela, good morning.
Good morning.
Can you please tell your story?
Yes, I am a 42, almost 43-year-old mom. I'm a teacher. I'm a librarian. I've been a teacher for 15 years, and I'm currently a high school librarian. And I have three kids. After I had my son, who's my last of the three, I just never felt right. I just never felt like I did before I had him. I was tired all the time, and I would catch colds easily, and those colds would turn into sinus infections, which would turn into bronchitis, which turned into pneumonia. And during all this time, I was super healthy. I mean, I say super healthy. I took care of myself. I watched what I ate. I tried to exercise every day. So it was odd that I kept getting sick and I kept getting sick.
Which I want to jump in and say so many people are probably telling you, I think this is where you're going. That new parent, you're going to get sick all the time.
Absolutely. And they're like, you're tired, you're not sleeping enough. And I was I'm a teacher, right? So at that point, I worked in an elementary. And so my other guess when I just couldn't get well was, you know, that the kids were getting me sick, you know, because I'm around 500. There was 500 kids in that school. And so for about legitimately probably two and a half years, I just felt awful. And I can't even explain how tired I was all the time. And, you know, I would be at the urgent care, I'd be at my primary care. And finally, my primary care said, well, maybe, you know, you should go to an allergist. And so I went to an allergist, I got all the allergy testing, and it came back negative. I was allergic to nothing is what the test showed. So then about 6 months after that, again, still feeling sick, you know, just on antibiotics and steroids most of the time, I went to an ENT. I was thinking I needed sinus surgery or something. So they did a scan of my sinuses, and he also did a little bit of blood work. He called me the next day and he said, your sinuses are fine, but your blood work is not right. And he referred me to a clinical immunologist, and I was in his office the next day.
So you were in this office and you got a diagnosis of?
Common variable immunodeficiency. But the tricky thing is, even though I was in my immunologist's office, this was probably February. I didn't get the official diagnosis until about 3 months later because of all the testing they have to do.
Whoa. So that sounds like a long 3 months to go through. At the end of it, you get this diagnosis. What does it mean?
So it means, I guess, depending on the severity of common variable immunodeficiency, because just like any disease, you know, there's a range of symptoms and I guess levels of it. I was, or I am, I guess, right, in like the moderate to severe. So my doctor recommended, and my husband and I talked about it, and we decided that I would receive human immunoglobulin injections, and I do that once every 28 days.
But what is the condition?
Oh, so the condition is common variable immunodeficiency, and it's categorized as a primary immune deficiency. So there's all sorts of immune deficiencies. you know, secondary immune deficiencies, your body attacks itself. With a primary immune, which is what I have, your body just, it does nothing. It's lazy. It lets anything invade. It just doesn't have the capabilities or the strength to fight bacteria and viruses and infections.
I'm curious whether you relate to the things you're hearing, stories of parents kind of advocating on behalf of very small children. Is there a difference in what it is you're dealing with when you're kind of like, it's me, it's my thing, I've got to take care of this for me?
Well, first of all, I thank God every day that this happened to me and not my kids. It's so hard with me, but at least I can describe what I'm feeling, and I can, and I know what feels right and what doesn't feel right. And
yeah, you had previous experience with your own body.
Right. So in that sense, I feel fortunate that it was me and not my kiddos.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious, Kelly, what you think of as some of those differences, having worked with a lot of people either dealing with their own rare diseases or advocating for children.
So I think that that's a really great question. And I appreciate, you know, Angela, you sharing the difference, because I do think there is a difference, right? I mean, in pediatrics or in children, you fight for a long time, or as in Janelle's case, you might get your diagnosis right away. But it is you as the parent that's fighting. And there's a lot of resources. So as you pointed out, nobody wants it, their child. I say that all the time. If I could take it off my child and deal with the challenges, I would take it any day. But in addition to the challenges that I think sometimes when you have an adult is in the pediatric world, a lot of times you do have specialists that are looking at rare conditions, versus when you get into the adult care setting, it becomes a little bit more challenging.
Like, surely we would already know.
Right.
Or I also can imagine that, I know this sounds strange, but I can imagine kind of giving up when it comes to yourself a little easier.
Yes.
Which is weird. And maybe like a bad sign of how we all feel about ourselves. But, you know, Angela, did you at any point feel like, you know what, I'm just going to keep getting bronchitis. I guess that's my lot in life.
Every day I felt that way. Is this really as bad as I think it is? You know, do I really feel this bad? And then in my head, you know, people were like, well, you're a new mom, you're a teacher, you're around kids all the time. Everybody's tired. And so then I became depressed to the fact that, oh my gosh, everybody feels the same way I do, but they're functioning and they're thriving. And I'm over here whining because I have a sinus headache. And so it was very, very disheartening. And really the only person who, because I didn't know what I had. I know now because I've researched it and advocated for myself. But during the time that 2-3 year period where I just felt horrible, I didn't tell anybody. I mean, my husband, I told him, but, you know, he was there for me, and he always believed me, and he always knew something wasn't right. And he just pushed me to keep going. And he's like, Ange, this isn't right. You know, this isn't normal. And so I don't know what I would have done had I not had that support system.
You know, I just also want to, we're about to take some calls, but when it comes to that kid piece, I have a friend with a kid who's maybe 7 years old, somewhere around there. And the kid had a rare kind of tumor. It took 3 pediatricians to identify it because the first 2 were insistent that the kid was kind of playing his parents because the symptoms struck in the middle of the night and the doctors thought, this sounds like nothing I've ever heard of and it sounds like a ploy to get out of bed. But the parents really like thought about their kid's personality and thought like, no, I don't think that's what's going on. And I'm wondering, Kelly, if you hear that a lot from the parents, that because of the dynamics between parents and children and kids sort of, quote, playing sick or faking sick, you know?
No, I think that that's a pretty common occurrence, especially with rare diseases. I think one of the biggest challenges that we face is You know, when you see a child who has a broken leg or you see a child that maybe has cancer, it's very apparent. And so there's a lot of empathy that goes along with that and a lot of belief that goes as the disease progresses. Or again, if you have a broken leg in a cast, everybody knows what's wrong. But with a lot of rare diseases, we call them almost invisible. They're not apparent on the outside. And so they do get challenged and they do. And even as a parent, there are times where you sit there going, okay, are you just really playing me or it's not? What I tell most parents is if you have a mom gut feeling, stick with that mom gut feeling for a long time.
There was also some difficulty with insurance covering it because it wasn't one of the standard things. So like that sort of chart, or I mean, maybe there isn't a chart, but I imagine a chart of like how necessary is this and certain things are listed. If that thing isn't listed, is that a common occurrence?
That is a common occurrence. I mean, as Janelle said, insurance, until you get a diagnosis, a lot of times you can't get coverage for things. And even in today's society that we have amazing advances in technology with genomic testing, most insurance companies still won't pay for it.
Well, and the other part of that, too, is that even if you do have a diagnosis, because it is such a rare disease, there's not a lot of research there. And so you can go to your doctor and say, you know, hey, my kid has X, Y, and Z, but we've never tested for this other thing that could also be part of his syndrome. And so the doctor will then try to get it covered by the insurance. But because the research hasn't been done and all you're working with is your Facebook group of other parents, then you can't get it covered then. So even when you do have a diagnosis, it can be really challenging.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And we are talking about the shared experience of people dealing with different rare diseases, all kinds of different rare diseases. And we're going to turn to listeners' stories at 816-235-2888. We've got Sarah in Prairie Village on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Please share your story.
Well, I'm sitting here wanting to laugh and cry at the same time as I listen to everybody. I'm a pediatrician and also a mom of a child with something called Wolfram syndrome, which is a 1 in 770,000 rare genetic disease. So I usually round up to 1 in a million, but 1 in 770,000-ish. And I'm calling partly to acknowledge just how hard it is to figure out a rare disease as a parent, and then also to acknowledge how hard it is to be faced with solving a rare disease puzzle in our current medical climate. Just from the doctor's side, some doctors, we're typically allotted about 10 to 20 minutes per patient, and there's so little time to figure out a complicated medical problem. And we are taught, as mentioned before, that if you hear hoofbeats, think of a horse, not a zebra. And as a mom, I felt crazy for a little while, saying something wasn't right with my child who appeared to have new onset diabetes, but her lab work pattern, I could tell it wasn't the usual pattern that we would see. And we were lucky to have a great endocrinologist who listened and helped us watch, and we worked on trying to figure it out. And I started as a pediatrician making calls and sending emails to my colleagues, and in 18 months, we got her genetic diagnosis.
What do you think that people maybe don't understand who aren't in it like you are about just what it means to have a rare disease and what you can do to kind of help juggle it? Obviously, if people are experiencing a physical symptom, something is going on. The whole like all in your head thing is just not helpful to anyone. But trying to figure out if it's a thing that your body is doing that you should live with, that you should not be fixated on, that you're going to be fine ultimately. I mean, we all have to sometimes tell ourselves like, okay, I feel weird, but I'm fine, and we get past it. And that's not always the case. Sometimes you actually need more information, more support. You know, how do you navigate that?
Oh, gosh, it's so hard. I agree so much with what the folks are saying there that you have, which is you do have to stick with it. There's a tendency to feel like you want to panic at times because you just know something's not right. And you're just hoping somebody will listen to you. And I was lucky that people really listened quickly. And maybe that's because of the pediatrician aspect of what I did. I don't know, but I suspect that played a role. But you do feel panicky. You want people to listen. You know something's not right. But you also don't want to come across as hysterical because then you fear people won't listen.
You know, and I want to point out that so far, I have a couple more callers to go to. The word hysterical is what makes me think of this. All of our callers are women. And I wonder if there is a gendered piece of how people receive information about unusual symptoms.
It's possible. And it also may be that we all share the common desire to puzzle solve. And I don't know if that's typically female or male. I don't think it is. But I think there are some of us who take the data and it's just sort of natural to say, I need to put this together and I won't rest until I put this together. Again, I don't think that's typically female or male, but I just think some people tend to do that more than others just by nature of who we are. And there are times when I wish I was less that way and a little more relaxed about everything. But I guess what I would say is that right now I'm on sabbatical, for the most part, looking for a treatment. My daughter's condition right now doesn't have a treatment, but luckily we've got a couple things now in the wings, which are really exciting. I'm hopeful that more providers could somehow go into work as advocates or puzzle solvers, and I don't know what name I would put on that part of the profession, and I know insurance really wouldn't cover that at this point, but interestingly enough, I went on sabbatical a number of weeks before my daughter was actually genetically diagnosed, planning to probably go into advocacy to try to help people, whether it's through the barter system or pro bono, to navigate the system and see if we could puzzle out by being able to spend a little more time.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for your call, Sarah.
Sure, sure. Thanks for having me.
And let's talk to Sarah in Stillwell. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And I'd like to thank Rare KC for being invited to this program today. We certainly appreciate bringing awareness to rare conditions.
Yeah, go on. Share your story.
My son has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, as do I. Typically, we're diagnosed when our kids are diagnosed. We don't realize that anything is wrong with us because our normal seems normal to us, therefore it must be normal to everybody. Being really bendy is not normal. Dislocating joints is not normal. Fainting a lot is not normal, but when you grow up with these things, along with pain, you just think that they're normal. But when your child is diagnosed, you take a closer look at yourself. I'm one of the administrators for our Facebook support group. We now have 508 members for this very rare condition. All of our members are local, and we realize there are a lot of us. So the first question that people always ask when they join our group is, okay, I've just been diagnosed or I think I have this, where do I go? And we don't have an answer for that question. Because there is no local specialist, there is no primary care doctor that they would see first that we could recommend. But what we do recommend is that they find a doctor that's kind, compassionate, and willing to listen. At this point, that is the best that we can ask for.
And it seems like those online support groups are helping folks a lot. But locally, Kelly Rinaldo of Rare KC, this is super interesting, important work. Thank you. And stay in touch, okay?
Thank you.
And Angela Van Batavia, Janelle Ridenour, thank you so much for sharing your family's stories.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm Gina Kaufman. When Central Standard returns, how to help a city fall back in love with the river that defines it. What city am I talking about? That's next. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're talking about the Missouri River, which the city we live in was built upon. But does it seem almost like everything about the way our city is built is an attempt to turn our backs on the river? It sure seemed that way to a grad student at Mizzou, Amaya Maea. All she wanted to do was ride her bike on the river. Since then, she's become a professor at Drake University, and she's written a book about us and our river. It's called A River on the City of Fountains. Hi, Amaya.
Hi.
Can you tell us the story of how you got interested in the river? I just alluded to it, but I'd like to hear the whole story.
Well, I moved to Missouri in 1999, and the two cities that I had been living in prior to moving for graduate school were Portland, Oregon, and Bilbao in the Basque Country in Spain. And both of those cities had recently gone through a renaissance. Portland in the 1970s, creating a public space that attracted people to the river. And Bilbao in the 1990s was an industrial city that reformed itself and most famously has one of Frank Gehry's Guggenheims along the river. And so my experience in falling in love with the Missouri and then learning that the single most important city on the river, making the river the way that it is Kansas City. And yet Kansas City didn't seem to recognize or be in love with the river that it had was, as you said, built on, but also had formed.
When you say that Kansas City formed the river, can you explain that briefly?
Yes. In the early 20th century, boosters were in love with the river, navigation of the river, and they worked very hard to shape the river for economic purposes, either for barge navigation and then later after World War II, especially for flood control. And so the narrow, straight-jacketed river that we are familiar with today, with levees and wing dams, is due in large part to the work that Kansas City did as lobbying for that.
You know, can you tell the story of attempting to bike along the river and noticing that Kansas City's relationship with it was kind of almost prohibitive in that respect?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I decided to take a bike trip up the river. I headed up towards North Dakota. I spent about 6 weeks on the road. And even though at that point I was already writing a dissertation on the Missouri River, and I spent so much effort to stay close to the river, and yet I couldn't when I came to passing Kansas City. I went up through Excelsior Springs because there isn't an infrastructure that allows for someone to stay near the river, whereas there are trails other places up through the Dakotas that you can stay closer to the river and be safe doing so. Kansas City doesn't have a public interface with the river. Now, that is a statement that is more accurate to the year 2000 because things have been changing. In the years I've been working on this book, I am able to conclude more optimistically that slowly Kansas Cityans are falling back in love with their river. And we're seeing more and more infrastructure, trail infrastructure, park infrastructure, a little bit of economic development that's happening down by the river. And that allows people to physically get closer to the river.
Yeah, I mean, you write sort of contextualizing that in an asterisk. You write that since the late 20th century or so like 1990s and on, rivers and river fronts have seen a resurgence in American cities in general.
Mm-hmm.
Is the change you're seeing in Kansas City just a part of that trend, or is it some particular kind of resurgence?
I would say that Kansas City is unique in the way it is responding to this trend. It is a trend. There's an economic redevelopment that's been happening along riverfronts. This is part of the environmental movement, cleaning up former industrial sites, and part of deindustrialization as well, as much of our manufacturing and production has moved overseas. These are landscapes that have moved from industries or meatpacking, for example, more into leisure landscapes. But Kansas City is behind the trend. I can't imagine when I was living in Portland, for example, some of the highest real estate, most expensive real estate, is down by the river. And that's really not the case yet in Kansas City.
Are we behind just because we're late on the uptake, or are we behind because of specific challenges that are making it tough to like get there?
I think there are some physical infrastructure and geography reasons. The bluffs, for example, while they can be an attribute, they can also be a deterrent to easily getting down to the bottoms. I think flood management and flood control, there's a flood wall, right? You go down to the bottoms, you probably can't get to the river because there's a big 15-foot wall there, or there's a rocky levee. So it's not a bank that you can sit on, for example. So currently, the area around the port and the bottoms is a carefully managed landscape. So there is the infrastructure and the geography, but there's also something else. And that's the way that Kansas Cityans have coded the Bottoms, the way that they think about the Bottoms culturally and socially.
Yeah, you have a whole chapter on this actually called Social Innards, where you explore how factors having nothing to do with land or geography have shaped how we approach the river, things like class and race.
Yeah, that's right. I think the Bottoms are certainly an area that has higher environmental risk. And therefore, people historically who could not afford to move south or after World War II to move into across the border into Kansas have remained in these high risk environments, of which creek sides and low areas, downstreamers, the Bottoms, those are some of the places with the highest environmental risk. And even though Kansas Cityans might not be aware of it, they do code those landscapes for their socioeconomic qualities.
Can you describe that a little more, be more specific?
So, for example, there was a phrase in the early 20th century, if you were someone who used to live in the Bottoms and you had moved out of the Bottoms, perhaps you had been successful economically and you had purchased a house or were now renting somewhere in the South. The phrase was that you were a come up from the Bottoms. So there was a sense that people who were poor or people of color or immigrants, the Vice District, that these are the places that are most associated with the riverside.
Come up and from the Bottoms?
Come up from the Bottoms.
I've never heard that before.
And maybe they stopped using it in the early 20th century.
But that is interesting. So, I mean, the story of how we relate to the Missouri River, you frame this as an exploration of the urban environment, meaning the things that mediate the relationship between people and the river, for example, sewers. But you also frame it as being about love, which I find more surprising.
Yeah, the way I think of Kansas City's relationship with the river culturally across the 20th century is that it's in love with the river, its potential for economic growth. And then after World War II and the 1951 flood, it falls out of love with the river. And then in the 1990s,
fair, that'll do it, you know?
Yeah. and then we start to see a pickup of interest in the river again. You know, now lots of people, lots of school kids, for example, may have an experience where they go down to the river and they participate in a cleanup. And it might even be on the Kaw River or on the Blue River. And so there are people are having experiences now where they are able to re-engage in the river. And so I do think that we're seeing a change.
You know, one of the blurbs on the book cover sort of says that this is a story about a larger conflict that goes beyond Kansas City between public health and economic wealth. And as I'm listening to you talk, I feel like you're also kind of saying that the public health is one public good that relates to the river, but now that there's an interest in public enjoyment, the conversation may be changing because that's a little maybe more democratic.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that...
And democratic meaning applying to everyone, including the more prosperous.
Yes, that's right. Even though people might, Kansas Cityans might ignore the river or might not recognize its role, it is literally running through the city. It is running through the city all of the time. And the city is incredibly dependent upon its waterway. But the way that it runs through the city, just as there is environmental risk, there is risk in using the river. And the river has been managed over the course of the 20th century for economic purposes and not to serve public health. And that was something that was concerning for me to recognize, that decade after decade, despite the fact that city leaders, despite the fact that environmental engineers and public health officials were constantly raising the alarm that the river was polluted, for example, or that it was being managed for economic purposes instead of public health purposes. Policy has not fallen in line with that.
Well, and you think that if we fall back in love with the river, that will help if we start seeing ourselves as being at this bend atop these bluffs?
Yeah, I do. I do. I recommend getting down to the river and getting out on the river whenever possible, reconnecting.
Well, thank you. Our time is up. Amaya Maea, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina.
Amaya is the author of A River in the City of Fountains. It was just published by the University Press of Kansas. And we've got to jog out of here. You can find this show and others at kcur.org/centralstandard. And that includes our portrait session with filmmaker Kevin Wilmot, who won an Oscar last night for BlacKkKlansman. Go, Kevin. We can hear what he has to say about that movie at kcur.org/centralstandard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.